Tobias Harivskalda and Frank, so the one that was also mentioned by Tobias in the previous talk. In the supplementary material, we have also tried to write the ground state of some relativistic quantum field theories using this formalism. And so the outline of this talk is as follows. So I will now really try to construct, especially for this case, I was first thinking about doing a blackboard talk and really deriving everything, but that would take too long. But I will still try to go over all the essential steps in the derivation of how we construct the ground states of this theory within this formalism of continuous mira. And well, as is noticeable here, these are all free theories, they are all quadratic, everything is very simple, of course. The main problem is, at this point, this is the only thing that we know how to do, because our variational parameters, as was explained by Tobias, it's no longer a collection of numbers, it's no longer a set of tensors that we have to optimize. The variational parameters in the continuous mira is really an operator, which can depend on this S parameter. So it will require some tricks and some good insights to see how we can, whether we can implement this in a kind of black box implementation that is applicable to interacting theories. But anyway, the fact that these are good ansatz even for interacting theories, the evidence for this is provided by all the experience of Giffrey and his collaborators with the lattice mira. So I think we can be hopeful for the future. So let me first come back to this first argument of Feynman that I concluded with yesterday. And I'll try to analyze why do matrix product states and in extensis also continuous matrix product states suffer from this problem. If you look at it, then you see that at what a matrix product state does is it's kind of renormalization procedure, which acts in a very special way, which exploits this area law of gapped quantum systems in the sense that everything that lives to the left can be compressed in just d, in an auxiliary system with just d quantum levels. And if you add a new side to this, well, the output of this is just, again, can again be compressed into d quantum levels, to a quantum auxiliary system with d levels. The problem with this is, so this compression scheme contains the variational parameters. And these are local degrees of freedom, but this necessarily implies that they affect both short and long length scales. And so since the set of parameters is finite, and the number of degrees of freedom on which they act is infinite, the variational principle will, as was argued by Feynman, will exploit all these parameters to first try to get the degrees of freedom at the short length scales correct. And if there would be some freedom left, then it might try to do something at the long length scales. But in a system with an infinite range of interacting degrees of freedom, so critical theories or relativistic theories, this is a major problem. And so the solution is actually quite straightforward. We need another ansatz, an ansatz which contains variational parameters that only affect the long length scales. And these are automatically protected against this major problem that Feynman had. And well, this ansatz exists, I think, as was argued in the previous talks this morning. The amazing evidence that was provided in Glenn's talk for critical systems. So this is indeed the mira. And if we look at the mira again, well, and you can see that degrees of freedom living in these tensors, they necessarily act at length scales which are larger than the lattice spacing times this e to the s, if you use a kind of logarithmic scale here so that you can use the natural exponential. And so the variational principle cannot exploit these degrees of freedom in here to optimize for short distance behavior because by the time we get here, the short distance behavior has already been integrated out. So this is really the kind of ansatz I think that Feynman was looking for. So we have now this continuous version thereof. So I use a slightly different notation than Tobias, so which is, I think, more conform to this picture, where S increases from bottom to top. And so we have a length scale SUV or S epsilon right here, and we stop at a length scale S infrared or S psi, S correlation length. And of course, we can set this one to zero and take this one to plus infinity. Because we have this different ordering, I use here something which is like a time ordering, but I call it scale ordering. And the only difference is it orders in the opposite way. So it will order from left to right, from small to in increasing value. So small values of S will be at the left, large values of S will be at the right. So S epsilon, the layer S epsilon is acting to the left. The layer at S psi is working here at the right directly at omega. So just bear this in mind. Then Tobias discussed how we can define these renormalized operators just by using part of this integration, part of this unitary from S epsilon to some value of S. This defines a renormalized operator at scale S as we're going up in the network. We have an initial condition for this, namely we at S epsilon, we just have our bare operator, as it would be called by people in quantum field theory. And if you want to evaluate an expectation value of an operator with respect to such a continuous mira, then we can just use our renormalized operator, which has been renormalized all the way up to the highest scale corresponding to the longest lengths in the system. And then we can just evaluate it with respect to this trivial state omega here. So I have not yet specified what all of this omega and this k, et cetera, is. So I will get to this in a minute. So we can rewrite this in a differential equation, which together with this initial condition determines the whole renormalization group flow. So this would be the equivalent of the renormalization group equation. But now in our formalism, this is an equation for operators instead of for classical fields in the patent legal or for expectation values. So we really have a kind of renormalization group flow in operator space.
Sorry.
Yes?
Name question. Where is the information about that you are studying the ground state, some extent? Because omega is real value.
I still have to specify what omega exactly is. The information about the state you're going to encode is contained in this matrix K. So this will contain all our variational parameters. And so as I said, this is in most general, so an operator, there are some constraints on it. It should be local. It should not be doing scale transformation. So L is a fixed scale transformation that is, in some sense, as you go up in the lattice, it's zooming out. So K should not be doing opposite scale transformations which are stronger than L or anything. So there are some constraints on what K can be, but it's quite general. And so this is a very wide class of variational parameters that we have available. The downside of this is that it's not numerical and that it's not easy to see how we can apply the variational principle to this in a general setting. So what else can we do with this renormalization group equation? We can look for fixed points. Well, let's say eigenvalues and eigenvectors, eigenoperators of this renormalization group equation when we have a critical system. So when we have a critical system, I hope that you were convinced by the arguments of Giffrey and Glenn this morning that the unitaries then, or the layers, will become scale independent. So this K of S will actually no longer depend on S. And I will illustrate this all with this one example that I will try to study carefully. So then K is S independent, and we can try to find operators which satisfy. If something wrong here, it's just vector X. So I forgot to use my LaTeX command for this. So just look for operators. And so this part did not appear on the lattice. This is actually what takes care of the fact that if you have a local operator at position X, that it gets as it gets rescaled, it also gets compacted towards the origin. So scaling transformation is not really translation invariant, which does not mean that this is not a translation invariant state, because if you act with a scale transformation on something that is translation invariant, even though the scaling itself has a kind of origin, since you are stretching out everything uniformly, in the end you still end up with a translation invariant state. So you can actually prove that this is still translation invariant. You can even do this rigorously. It's one of the few things you can probably do rigorously. So but this takes care of this, this thing. So if you look in the renormalization group papers of Wilson, you will also find similar equations. The only, well, the difference is, of course, here he just has some kind of renormalization group transformation, and the O's are not operators in an operator space, that are just classical fields. But this term will also be there for local operators. And then this here is the important part. This lambda determines, of course, the scaling dimension. So if you would integrate this, then you would see that O renormalizes S. So if you have found a solution of this equation, then the renormalized version of O at the scale S would just be e to the lambda S, the original operator at the scale or at the position. I think it's like this. There's also an S. This is not a lambda here. This is just X gets scaled at the position gets rescaled in such a way, just with a constant rate, so it's with a rate velocity or a scaling velocity 1. And then correspondingly, the norm of O gets some kind of rescaling proportional with this scaling dimension. So what is our expression? The question is, of course, which k do we use? Even which l do we use in the relativistic setting? It's not.
Well, capital D is the physical dimension, right?
This is an S. So this lambda, okay, that's a good point. Let me go back. So this lambda contains both the canonical dimension and the anomalous part. So you can somewhat argue that L is responsible in itself for the canonical dimension, and this is exactly what I need for the point I'm going to make next. But then this K can change this lambda, and so add an anomalous contribution to it. So this is actually a very nice way of looking at this. So the main question is, which k do we use? How are we going to parameterize? Clearly, we cannot work with arbitrary k, and especially not in the electric study. But even with L, so as I said, L determines the canonical dimension. So L takes care of this contraction towards the origin, but also takes care of canonical dimensions. And so with relativistic fields, they don't have the same canonical dimensions as just these creation and annihilation operators, so we might want to correct for this. And then also, which vacuum are we going to use? So choice of K, in principle, we can use any set of operators. So this is an important point. We're no longer restricted, in contrast to continuous matrix product state of yesterday, we're no longer restricted to creation and annihilation operators. So we can use the bosonic field and its conjugate momentum. We can use gauge fields here. And we can try to impose symmetries. So if we want to create a state which is Gates invariant, we can just try to build K out of Gates invariant operators and choose an omega which is Gates invariant and this produce a Gates invariant state. So this is a very, very interesting prospect. So as I said, L determines the canonical scaling dimensions. And then omega, well, at least for gapped systems or critical systems at critical points near gap systems, this is a factorized state with no entanglement. I'm not completely certain whether this changes for topological order. It should change. So, but for the fields we're going to study for today, this would just be a factorized state. Because this is exactly what this unitary process is supposed to be doing. It's supposed to disentangle everything if you work upwards, or entangle all degrees of freedom if you work downwards.
Factorized in
real space, yes. Not in momentum space. Because
if you have topological order, presumably close to a topological quantum field theory, so it would be the vacuum, that state omega would be where you flow in the case of a topologically ordered system. You would flow to a TQFT, presumably.
Why? So that, because that's the description you would have
at the UV.
No, that's so, that, no, no, not the UV. That would be at
omega.
The UV.
Yeah, doesn't omega live in UV?
No, no, no. Omega is what remains after you're finished with your complete renormalization group process. So somehow this this will become, I think, more clear in the explicit example. So which I'm going to start now. And so I really hope that everybody can follow this. So whenever there's something unclear, just stop me and ask me. So we're first going to look at three fermions, relativistic, or the Dirac equation, in 1 plus 1 dimension. So this is the Dirac Hamiltonian. We have this, so the fields, the psi's, are two component spinors. So there's a psi 1 and a psi 2. And this A, this alpha, and this beta is a 2 by 2 matrix. We have some freedom in how we choose them. This choice was mainly motivated by the fact that you get real coefficients in real space if you use this convention, which is nice for numerical methods, which was absolutely not necessary here. But since we also studied this Hamiltonian with continuous matrix product states, it was nice that everything was real in real space. And then you can also define the gamma matrices. I will use them at the end of my derivation to show, to better illustrate what the symmetry is of the unitary network that I will use. So this is the Hamiltonian. Next question is, what is K? So I'm just providing you with this K. I'm not going to try to argue. I actually made a mistake. So it's psi 1 dagger psi 2 plus psi 2 dagger psi 1. It's number preserving. So this is actually this is from working with the non-relativistic case there. Well, you have the squeezing operating, but in the relativistic case you can just use psi 1 dagger psi 2 plus psi 2 psi 1 psi 2 dagger psi 1. So this K will reappear at the end of this case study, and that will hopefully be correct. So of all of the possible set of operators that we could have chosen from, we're going to use this choice, where the only free variational parameters that remain are now in this scalar valued function, which depends on the momentum LS. So the way it depends on the momentum is mainly dictated by the cutoff. So in the end, we're just going to use the following proposal for this function g, where everything is fixed except for the sky. So we have gone from variational parameters, which are operators depending on S, to a single scalar valued function that only depends on S. So we just have, for every layer, we have one number, and this determines our variational ansatz. Kai, gamma is a cutoff function with cutoff at the dimensionless scale 1, so you could use any cutoff you like. The Gaussian is particularly nice because it's very smooth both in real space and momentum space. If you use some exponential cutoff in momentum space, it's not really short-ranged in real space. It's quite wide, so this is a less acceptable choice. This would be theta, the Heaviside function. So this would be really a sharp cutoff in momentum space. So this would correspond to having these operators psi 1 and psi 2 quite far apart in real space, because it would only decay like 1 over the distance between the two. In the end, I will already give it away. I will use this one because of the convenience of computing with it. But I hope that I will be able to convince you that I could just as well have chosen this one. It's just that at some point I will have to solve an integral equation where this cutoff function appears as a kernel. And it's easier when we have this sharp kernel than, because then it's not really an integral equation anymore.
Last time we had an expression where K was in momentum space. I think we lost Pedro at that point. And he never came back. So can you give an idea, a more clear idea of how K of S looks in real space?
Definitely.
For instance, if you have the exponential of minus the Gaussian.
The Gaussian is nice. So it would look like. Up to some normalization factors, it would be where epsilon is exactly the inverse of lambda. So you have psi 1 dagger at position x. This is going to disappear behind the screen, probably. Yeah, I can stop here. So we have psi 1 dagger and psi 2. We take the derivative of psi 2 because there's a p there. Well, then, what is this? And to have the correct dimensions, so to also have a 1 over lambda here or an epsilon. So they are at different positions, but it's local in the sense that these two positions where these operators can be is very much restricted to be within order epsilon. So it's not exactly local, but it's very, very close together. So this epsilon is supposed to be very, very small. And in the end, what we will do is we can take the limit epsilon going to 0. But as with any renormalization group procedure, you should only do this at the end. You always need to introduce some kind of regularization. You need to start your procedure somewhere. So you have to introduce a cutoff. And at the end, you can try to see what your result will be if you set this cutoff back to infinity. But it's useless to do this in the beginning because, there's this 1 over lambda here. So there will be nothing left if you do this from the start. You just have to do this in a consistent way. So this would be the first term, and the second term is just a complex conjugate or the Hermitian conjugate to this.
Then you have to add fermions.
This is for fermions, yes.
But it's just displacing the fermion. It's not adding.
It's not adding them. No, it's not adding them. And you will see immediately when I write down the omega why I can do this. It's not adding any fermions, so this is the correct form. It's for fermions. I will also do bosons at the end. The L operator, the scaling operator for fermions, we have the same canonical scaling dimensions in the relativistic case as in the non-relativistic case. Can just use the non-relativistic one. Well, it's also the relativistic scaling generator. Yes.
Is there a reason why K has to be quantitative?
Because this is the only thing we can compute with. That's the problem. And so this is also why we're only going to study free theories today. So we have to integrate. So in order to, what do you have to do in order to try to optimize this, or just to compute an expectation value? The easiest way to do it is to compute this renormalization group flow, this trajectory, and then if you are able to do this from S epsilon at the bottom to S xi all the way to the top, then it's very easy to evaluate the expectation value, because then you can use a simple state omega. But in order to integrate this renormalization group equation, it's like solving a Heisenberg equation of motion. The only case where we know how to do it exactly is for the quadratic case. And so our ansatz, if we use some quadratic ansatz for k, then our state that we are preparing with the Chimera construction will be a Gaussian. So we could try to apply it to an interacting theory, and it would just be some mean field approximation. But just to illustrate the argument, we only apply it to the free theories.
So by choosing this specific form, are you choosing some specific mean field ansatz?
Yes, it's actually a very restricted mean field ansatz. But it turns out, of course, that this form is just the one that does what I wanted to do. You will see that this encodes the ground state of free fermions almost exactly.
So by choosing this, you want to generate some mass gap for the formula?
Yeah, I can. Well, so if I start from a Hamiltonian which has some mass, for which the mass is non-zero, then I will be able to choose a chi of s in such a way that I have a ground state of a massive theory, of massive relativistic fermions. If I start from a Hamiltonian which doesn't have the mass gap, which is at the critical point, then there will be another chi of s which corresponds to this case.
So your omega in that case is a Dirac vacuum.
No. Omega, because the Dirac vacuum, so in the end, that's what you mean by Dirac vacuum, having all the Dirac C-fold. This is the ground state we want to create. But this is, in real space, this is a very complicated state because it has all entanglement, etc. So our omega, I think it's on the next slide. Our omega is one that has, in real space, no entanglement at all. It's a product state.
But then what about the fermions? There are no fermions. Also.
There are fermions.
Where do you put them and how do you?
So, it's, yeah, so the omega, it has all the psi 1 fermions, all the levels corresponding to psi 1 are empty, all the levels corresponding to psi 2 are filled.
So that means it's a filled band.
It's a filled band, but it's not this one. Because if you solve the Dirac equation, so the single particle equation, These two dispersion relations that you obtain.
When you have a filled band, you can fill them in momentum space, or you can fill them in real space. Both are identical. In fact, you can go back and forth.
Yes.
If you have a spinless fermion.
Yes.
In a simple tight binding band.
Indeed. But the point is, so quadratic theories, you can always solve, so sometimes you have to do Bohr-Lyubov quotations, but in the end, you can always solve them by filling some levels. But the big difference is, if the way you fill levels does not depend on the momentum, then if you just Fourier transform back, it's trivial in real space. It's the same as filling all the levels in real space. And so it's product state. There is no entanglement. It's very simple. If the way you fill levels depends on the momentum, then it becomes very complicated in real space. And then you have entanglement. Then you have all these strange properties. And so these two dispersion relations that I also drew yesterday, these correspond to very non-trivial linear combinations of the psi 1 and the psi 2, which are moment, and the linear combination is momentum dependent. Because in the massive case, this corresponds to psi 2, and this one corresponds to psi 1, exactly at momentum 0. But at all other values of the momentum, you have to make certain linear superpositions.
So that is the renormalization.
What?
That is a renormalization. But at the end of the day, you have a Dirac vacuum in which you can create a positron or you can create an electron.
When the mega is finished. So the MIRA, what the MIRA is trying to do is really trying, but it's slightly different. So yesterday we started from an omega which was completely zero, and we really tried to fill these levels from out of the blue. Now we have this reservoir of fermions sitting there, present, but not, they're not here. They are, yeah, it's, so the omega, and it's on one of the next slides, so it satisfies all psi 1 levels in real space or in momentum space, it doesn't matter, are zero. And all psi 2 levels are filled. So acting with psi dagger 2 on omega produces zero. So you have these fermions present, but they are in some linear combination of these two. They're not filling the anti-particle state. They are, well, the correct way of looking at this, this level is a linear combination of these two.
So if, coming through the mass matrix, is it?
What?
The mass term.
Yes.
Is what mixes what you call as hole and particle. See, there is a beat. If you go to the Hamiltonian.
In the Hamiltonian or in the K?
Yeah, in the Hamiltonian. No, I'm just trying to understand. Yeah. So there is a mass. Next.
Yeah. Yes. So here you have the mass term, yes. And beta is sigma z. So the mass is positive for the levels psi 1. It's m times psi 1 dagger psi 1. And it's minus m psi 2 dagger psi 2.
So that doesn't cause any mixing between.
No, not at momentum 0. At momentum 0, so when the first term, this is the kinetic energy. When this one is zero, so at momentum zero, this point exactly corresponds to psi 1, this point exactly corresponds to psi 2. But as soon as you go to non-zero momenta, then you start to mix these levels, because this term, this alpha is a sigma y, so this term couples psi 1 with psi 2, and psi 2 with psi 1. So all these other points at the dispersion relation are
so you start again with the product state.
I start with the product state.
This is omega.
Yes.
And then you slowly rotate things.
Indeed.
So that's
momentum dependent.
Right.
That's the picture. But in momentum space, it's clear it's just rotating. Because also in momentum space, the initial state is a product state. But in the end, it should still be a product state in momentum space. That's the exact solution of a free theory. There is no entanglement in momentum space. But the correct way of looking at the MIRA is not at what it does in momentum space, it's what it does in real space. And so these rotations in momentum space, which are momentum dependent, this corresponds to entanglement in real space. And in real space, it's really taking two particles and entangling them.
So your K is basically doing Bobolev rotation.
Yes, exactly. This K is chosen such that it generates Bobolev rotations in momentum space. But it's formulated in real space. Well, no, it's formulated in momentum space. But you can formulate it in real space, and it's still nicely local. That's the main point of it. And this is what the MIRA has learned us, that this is the basic ingredient. And this also, so for interacting theories, it will have to do something much more complex, but it will still remain local in real space. So what it does in momentum space is not a constant. I mean, can be completely different for free and interacting theory. So this is not a specifying characteristic property of this K. So you shouldn't attach too much value to this. It's properties in real space that are important. Okay. So with this K, we can, so the omega is on the slide. Okay, the omega is over there for now. With this K, we can integrate the normalization group equations first for the field operators themselves. And indeed, this is what it does. It creates in momentum space, it creates a Bohr-Lyubov rotation. It does, of course, also the scaling. The L part takes care of the scaling. And so you have this function f here, and this function f is determined by this g in an integrated form. So this is, in the end, this integral equation that I was talking about. So we can then substitute this into the Hamiltonian. It looks like this. And this is the same thing as if you would be solving a theory with Bohr-Lyubov rotation. Now you will try to force some terms to be zero, especially these mixed terms. But you can actually do this pretty nicely by specifying our omega. So here it is. And then in the end, our whole so we can define the energy expectation value just by computing this with this omega. And the only variational parameters we had was this function chi. So maybe I should turn back. This function, these were our variational parameters, one number per layer s. And we can just apply the variational principle, which tells us to minimize the energy with respect to the variational parameters. So it's a functional derivative with respect to chi of s. And if you work this out, then you see that in this energy expectation value, you will try to impose that this f is exactly what you would find if you would do Bohr-Lyubov substitution. So it's, in the end, a very complex way. Well, this exercise is just a very, very complex way of doing a Bohr-Lyubov rotation. But you should keep in mind that it's supposed to be much more general than this. This, the whole scheme, even though the example that we study is very simple, the whole scheme has provided ample evidence on the lattice that it also works for interacting theories. And the only property you still have to satisfy is this locality, or that you can, it's not so much that you have to satisfy this, it's nice that you can use local case, because this makes the evaluation simple, at least in the lattice, in the continuum. We're thinking about how we can do it, and it doesn't seem impossible, so we have good hopes that we will be able to actually find an implementation of this, which can start from an interacting theory. So this is what we try, what the chi should be doing. So this chi should be chosen so that f satisfies this, so we have to solve this integral equation. And this should just as well work with this Gaussian kernel. So this, in the end, this cutoff acts as a kind of a kernel. And this should also be solvable with the Gaussian kernel. But when I did this, it was just much easier to use the sharp momentum cutoff. But this doesn't invalidate the fact that it should also work. So a sharp cutoff is cheating a bit, because it's not really local anymore in real space. But I'm pretty certain, and in the end, for interacting theories, we will have to use the Gaussian cutoff. I mean, the sharp momentum cutoff is nice, is easy for free theories, but this is not a basic ingredient. And for interacting theories, there will be no point in trying to use a sharp momentum cutoff, because this would be like doing perturbation theory and based on momentum space renormalization. So we will use a real space cutoff there. And then this is what you find for chi of s. And so at s is zero, and this corresponds to this s epsilon, so I have set s epsilon equal to zero, and I'm integrating upwards to this s psi. There is this somewhat artifact that you have an infinitely strong k, but this is, you can attribute it to a number of reasons. Firstly, it's due to our sharp momentum cutoff. So with the Gaussian, we probably would have found something else. We could just restrict k not to have unbounded. We could just restrict this chi to be smaller than some maximal value. And then, so the reason that this appears here is, in the end, because we have not regularized our Hamiltonian. We have just tried to apply a ground state which has an intrinsic cutoff built in. And so what it does, if you apply the variational principle, you start at the slowest in the slowest layer, which acts at very high momenta, and it immediately has to do a very big Bohr-Lyubov rotation. So it needs, and it only has an infinitesimally small time for this, because as you move up in the network, you will be in momentum space, everything will be stretched out. So in the next layer, K will no longer have access to this to these degrees of freedom living at the previous cutoff scale, because they will be scaled outside of the cutoff. They will be larger as a cutoff now. So again, this is clearly that this is because we have this sharp cutoff. So what it does in order to also correct for these degrees of freedom living at the cutoff is just by acting at them for an infinitesimally small time step with an infinitely large strength. But once it has done this, then after this, all the rest is nicely smooth and regular. And we can easily argue that, so either you work with some kind of regularized Hamiltonian and then you wouldn't need this. And this is what we see with the non-relativistic examples, which are regular in itself. Or another way to do it is if we look at it from top to bottom, it's not stopped anywhere. Just continue all the way down to like S minus infinity. And then you wouldn't need this. So this will be more clear when I plot the sky. So this is sky for chi of S. For a number of values of the mass in the direct Hamiltonian as a function of S. So when we have a mass gap, which is of the order of 10 to the exponential of minus 15 times the cutoff, what you see is your chi of S. So mind that zero is here. So chi of S is, so the operator K is acting all the way up to a time scale, well, and this S time, so this scale in the Mira network around 15, and then its strength drops to zero. You can stop it with entangling, and it's fine. If you use a mass gap which is exponential of minus 5, you can stop around S equal to 5. So this is what would happen in the Mira. If you use the Mira for a gap system, you have a number of layers, and at some point, your system is completely disentangled, and you can just put a product state there. So here, you see it's not really a sharp transition, it's just a smooth transition. So your K will smoothly go to zero. And so it never gets exactly zero anywhere, but if you stop here, so if you don't let this S psi, this upper limit going to infinity, if you just stop it at some finite value, then you don't make a large approximation to your exact ground state if the system is gapped. If the system is critical, so if there's no mass, then you have to continue doing this entangling or disentangling all the way up to S is infinity. So this is the scale, and you see it's constant. So we have studied in these non-relativistic examples, what you see is it's the other way around. If you choose the cutoff of the K much smaller than the intrinsic cutoff of the system, then in the beginning K is doing nothing, and then it starts acting. And then if it's cracked, it stops acting again. If it's critical, it does nothing in the ultraviolet, and then it starts acting, and it goes towards a horizontal asymptote, and then it remains acting like this all the way up to infinity. So this is the scale invariance is actually somewhat an asymptotic limit. But in these relativistic theories, it's already there from the start, and in fact, if you would only start there, you would have some very, very strong transition effect here. So it's actually better not to start anywhere, just if you would work in the other way, to continue going to minus infinity, or just to actually to start with a cutoff which is infinity, or which is zero length scale. So this is, I think, the correct interpretation that we have from relativistic theories. It's like critical theories in the other direction. So, yes?
So, you started with the product state.
Yes.
Why couldn't you use this this vacuum with this DMPS? What would fail it?
This direct vacuum? Or no?
The original one, the one where you...
This one?
Yes.
I guess you could also use it. Requires a slightly different regularization then, but you could probably also use it. It's just Yeah, with CMPS, I think you can also use this vacuum. Just the choice we didn't make at that point. And with continuous MIRA, it was more natural to use this one because then you can use this U1 invariant, so the number preserving, the fermion number preserving symmetry of the Dirac Hamiltonian. If you start from a ground state which has already the correct degrees of freedom present, or the correct number of particles somehow present, then you can use a number preserving K to prepare the correct ground state. We could also have started from the other one, but then our K would have to be chosen so that it generates actual particles, that creates pairs of particles, so that it wouldn't be number preserving. So you wouldn't see this symmetry of the Hamiltonian in K. It doesn't mean that the ground state wouldn't have this symmetry, it wouldn't be visible.
So,
yes?
Along this curve, is it true that the state evolves from Dirac product state in real space into Dirac product state in momentum?
In momentum space, it has always been a product state, because even this omega in real space is also a product state in momentum space. If I would choose something which is a product state in a real space, but in a way that it's dependent on x, so that's not translation invariant, then in momentum space it would not be a product state. So this is always a point. So if you specify some state by some condition, if this condition does not depend on x, then you could just as well have written it in P. But if it depends on X in some way, because there's, I don't know, some non-linear a combination of these two conditions with an X-dependent coefficient, then if you would Fourier transform that, it would be non-trivial in momentum space, and so it would be in somewhat entangled, there would be entanglement in momentum space. But this omega, as we chose it here, was from the start product state in momentum space. And in the end, it's still a product state in momentum space. So in momentum space, we haven't really done anything except these Bohr-Lyubov rotations. Well, this is a lot.
So the real space entanglement keep increasing as S increases.
Yes.
And then if you measure momentum entanglement entropy in momentum space, is it peak at the first order scale?
The entanglement in momentum space,
yeah.
Just will be zero. It's a product state.
It's always zero.
It's always a product state.
Well, you actually mix psi 1 or psi 2 in momentum space.
Yes.
But so for even momentum, you would have entanglement between psi k 1.
Yes.
Psi 1 k and psi.
The particle, the different flavors would be entangled. But if you look at entanglement between degrees of freedom living at different momentum scales.
But if you divide momentum space into half, then there's no entanglement at all.
No.
Or
yes, indeed.
So this is what you are saying all the time, right? In momentum space, all this process looks trivial. In real space, you go from a product state to an entangled state. And now the role would be to apply the same strategy to an interaction.
Yes, and then this whole momentum picture falls down, but the real picture, the real space picture still stays valid. So this is why you shouldn't touch too much value to this momentum space picture. For the case of MIRA. Okay?
So you still have more
models? Yes, but these are very quickly once this is done. I can try to speed up. So we can look at fixed point Hamiltonians. Just look at what does the normalized Hamiltonian look like for infinite S. In the critical case, you get this one with the correct scaling exponent. And this, you see what has happened is that it has actually transformed to, so you need to remember that the vacuum is defined in such a way, so you actually have here particles psi 1 with a positive dispersion relation, you have particles psi 2 which, if you look at how your omega is defined, also have a positive dispersion relation. In the non-critical case, it's basically the same thing, but then, well, you would also have this coefficient, but your mass is something that will increase exponentially as you do the scaling, so because this is a relevant perturbation to the massless Hamiltonian, so this with scaling dimension 1, so your mass, as you go up and up, the effect of the mass term increases, and so for infinite S, the only thing you see is massive fermions and kinetic energy has disappeared. So just at this point, you see that indeed the correct solution is product state, which is exactly this product state. So it looks like the direct Hamiltonian at momentum is zero, but now at all momenta, somehow.
So that could be like non-relativistic fermions in solid state.
Yes.
You have a large mass.
But the thing, yeah.
Practical purposes.
Well, on a lattice, it's quite clear. If you have a gapped system, and as you do scaling transformations, the gap will increase and increase, and in the end, your gap will be much larger than your lattice spin 1 over the lattice spacing, so you will just have a product state. This is kind of the point. So here I just rewrite this k, and I again start from the wrong expression, so but from here on, it's right. So here I write it in a, using the Dirac matrix, so in a way that it's a bit more clear what this actually is. So what you see is actually, here I use psi bar, which was introduced by Dirac or by Feynman, I think by Feynman. In such a way that, well, this, for people familiar with basic relativistic QFT, this is something that transforms as an anti-symmetric tensor, so this part, but then you multiply it with the spatial component of a vector. So in one dimension, it's not really clear. So in the end, this is just a Lorentz. It's like the zero component of a Lorentz 2 vector in 1 plus 1. Let me go to 3 plus 1. It's actually, it doesn't take any time. For 3 plus 1, the k you need to use is this one. It's exactly the same thing, but now it's just the product of the scalar product over the t vector, over the t spatial indices. So the k really looks like the zero component of a 4 vector. So it's definitely not Lorentz invariant, but as I said yesterday, this is impossible to obtain if you're going to do regularization in a wave function in a Hamiltonian framework. You will not end up with something that is Lorentz invariant. That's impossible. But in the except for that, so you have something which, if you only look at symmetries in three-dimensional space, it's a vector times a vector, so it's a scalar with respect to rotations, and it's translation invariant. So you have the spatial symmetries are present. Lorentz invariant is, of course, impossible to recover. At least that's what I think. And then finally, bosons. So here is the issue with the scaling dimensions. In the non-relativistic case, you have these scaling dimensions. If you define the proper relativistic fields, which you kind of relate somehow to the symmetric and anti-symmetric combination of creation and annihilation operators. But it's not exactly this because they have different scaling dimensions. And so the question is, do we use an L which generates these canonical scaling dimensions, or do we use an L which generates these? And so I think the most obvious choice is we use these because we're doing relativistic theories. The thing is, if we have a gap theory, then we know that k should be zero after a while. And so it's only L that remains. And so for a gap theory, we should wonder, are these the relevant scaling operators? And it turns out that they're not, because for a gap theory, in the end, you can just create localized gapped particles, particles and antiparticles are the same in this in the Klein-Gordon model, in the real Klein-Gordon model. So in the gap theory, in the end, you should end up that these are indeed the correct scaling operators. And in the gapless case, in the critical case, these are the correct scaling operators, but then we still have k. So this might maybe not really convince you, but so I decided to use an L which produces these scaling dimensions, but I'm going to formulate everything using the relativistic operators. So this L looks like this, formulated in terms of phi and pi. And then for k, well, we use our intuition from the fermionic case. We use the zero component of a 4 vector, and there is such a combination. Phi times pi is the zero component of a 4 vector. And we use this operator k, where the variational degrees of freedom in the end are once again reduced to a single scalar valued function of s. And so this looks somewhat similar to this k here, except there is no derivative, and it's a phi and a pi. So it's, again, local with some smearing, with some smoothing. And then the chi of S that produces the correct result is this one. So if m is non-zero, then for large values of S, well, this will just go to zero, as before. So you will, there will be some transition behavior. I haven't made a plot here, I believe. No, there will be some transition behavior around the scale of S, which corresponds exactly to the small scale. If m is zero, then this is just 1/2. So we just have chi of S 1/2 everywhere. And then what this does, well, you can see that this part is exactly the same as appears here, except that it's only acting below the cutoff. But what it does is, you have to work it out. It's not completely obvious from scratch. But so in the massless case, when this chi is just 1/2, it actually restores the proper canonical scaling dimensions for the fields phi and pi. So it restores these scaling dimensions. So in this picture, we somehow interpret this as a canonical scaling dimension of the fields phi and pi. And then these contributions, the minus 1/2 and the plus 1/2, we should somehow call them anomalous in this picture. Of course, this is not really correct, but this is the way the mirror seems to be doing it. So this is to the end of my talk. So I think we can conclude that the continuous mirror are perfectly suited to study these relativistic theories, and it would be, well, it would actually be better to not start anywhere, but just to formulate the mirror in such a way that even in the ultraviolet regime, it can continue forever. And then this really corresponds to the relativistic theory without a cutoff. But of course, to do any computation, we always have to introduce a cutoff. This is quite obvious. So the range between the infrared and the ultraviolet cutoff can be arbitrarily large. So this is just because we don't have this Feynman sensitivity to high frequencies. So I plotted this thing for this chi of S for free fermions, where the mass, the ratio between the mass and the cutoff was e to the minus 15. If you would try to do this with a continuous matrix product state or with a matrix product state, try a lattice model where the gap in the system is of the order of exponential of minus 15, so this is 10 to the minus, I don't know what, 8. I think that you will have to go to bottom dimensions of 1 million before you get to get the right solution. With Mira and continuous Mira, doubling the cutoff or doubling this range of interacting scales, it's just adding a constant length to your total integration, to your total number of layers. You just have to add a constant number of layers, and you can double the total range of interacting scales. So with continuous mirror, we have great flexibility in how to choose k. There's a lot of freedom. So it's definitely worth looking at gauge theories. But of course, the main thing is trying to understand how we can do interacting theories. This is, if we can do this, then I think we have a very powerful approach here.